The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Elena Nicolou is titled "Own's New Documentary, Eggs Over Easy, Starts a Conversation About Black Women and Fertility." Andra Day vividly remembers the doctor's appointment that changed the way she thought about her fertility, or more specifically, made her start thinking about fertility at all. The Grammy-nominated performer, singer, and activist was preparing for a demanding starring role in the biopic The United States vs. Billie Holiday, for which she would have to rapidly lose 40 pounds and endure harrowing scenes. She visited a doctor to see if her body could handle what was sure to be a difficult experience. To her surprise, Day's doctor gave her advice that had little to do with the fictional role and much to do with real life. She suggested Day, then 34, consider freezing her eggs, in part due to the stress of the film and in part due to her age. "At the time, it was too much for me to process," says Day. "I was just like, I just have to focus on the next thing that I'm doing, which is this film." For most of her 20s, Day hadn't considered having children, but the birth of her niece and nephew made her consider the possibility. After that appointment, Day began thinking more seriously about what it might take to get pregnant and why it might be harder than she expected. "Not only is my age a factor, race is also a factor," Day says of her ensuing revelations. "Studies find black women experience infertility at 1.5 times the rate of white women." Day speaks on her self-education in the OWN Spotlight documentary, Eggs Over Easy, Black Women and Fertility, which premiered Tuesday, January 4th on OWN and will be available to stream on Discovery+. In the documentary, Day voices a sentiment about starting a family that many of the other featured women share. "I always thought I would have more time." Directed by Chiquita Lockley and hosted by Keisha Knight Pullum, Eggs Over Easy, Black Women and Fertility addresses many different facets regarding fertility, including conditions like fibroids, PCOS, and endometriosis, adoption, miscarriages, stillbirths, and maternal mortality, and solutions such as IVF treatments and sperm and egg donations. Eggs Over Easy shows how race in America gravely affects many black women's fertility journeys, both from medical and emotional standpoints. Black women are 3 times more likely than white women to die during childbirth, for example, per CDC data. While reflecting on her stillbirth, documentary participant Tanya Cobb said she felt there was a stereotypical expectation that she would recover quickly. "As black women, we're supposed to put on this cape. We're supposed to go to work. We're supposed to raise children with or without a man. We're supposed to take care of the family. We don't have time to take care of ourselves," Cobb says in the documentary. In addition to unpacking the science behind fertility through animated sequences and accessible interviews with medical professionals, Eggs Over Easy tackles the idea of societal mandates and the pervasive pressure women face to have children. "There's the idea that as women, we are supposed to have babies and we are supposed to give birth," Day says. "You're a difficult woman if you're not thinking about kids. Then if there's an issue with it, you're somehow broken." The breadth of the 90-minute documentary's subject matter makes sense considering its intention, starting a conversation that demystifies the multifaceted subject of fertility. Growing up in a Christian community, Day says she never spoke about fertility with her friends or relatives. "There's so much that is taboo that you're not supposed to talk about," Day says. Had this been a topic she had discussed with her close friends and family, Day says she might have had a plan for herself and definitely would have had more of an awareness. Day began sharing her own story in the press back in April 2021 for National Infertility Awareness Week, and again for the documentary to break the silence. "It wasn't really a difficult decision. I put it like this: if something's truthful, I'm down. If there's something that we can learn from as a community, I'm down," Day says. Certainly, the documentary demonstrates a yearning for connection among people on this path. When documentary participant Tanya James posted about the anniversary of her miscarriage on Facebook, she said her inbox quickly filled up. I had people that had been through it before and they didn't want to talk about it publicly. Then I had people that had recently experienced it. They had no one to talk to, James said. Similarly, life coach Jessie Thompson ended up writing the book Hope Beyond Fibroids because her 2020 story in Essence about her 10-year struggle with uterine fibroids and infertility resonated with readers so much. According to the NIH and presented in the documentary, an estimated 80% to 90% of black women are likely to develop fibroids by age 50. When I saw how much the story was empowering and encouraging so many women, I said, "Wait a minute, this is more than about me," Thompson said. "God made a message out of my mess." Though Day is planning to freeze her eggs and hopes to adopt children one day, she has not yet begun growing her family, unlike most of the other women featured in the documentary. Day says she initially felt unqualified to participate in the documentary when her friend producer Felicia Fant approached her. "Then I realized it's a journey. Some people are further along. They've had successes and they've had obstacles to overcome. Some people are literally just starting, which is me," Day says. Hearing from other women in Eggs Over Easy, Day says, was a continuation of the educational journey that started in that doctor's office. Education, she says, remains the most important part. "It seems so much effort has been made to keep us kind of unaware about things. We should be that much more diligent in making sure we have all of the information so that we have all of our options," she says. Our next article by Ethan Gilsdorf is titled, "Facing Childhood Trauma Led a Grown Son to Healing." Picture me as a 19-year-old at a college party, chatting with a new friend or crush, hearing about their hometown, then trying to explain who I am. My short story, I'd say, is that in 1978, my mother was cut down by a brain aneurysm. It paralyzed her body on one side and scrambled her personality and behavior. She was 38, I was 12. Seeing the horror and pity in the other person's eyes, I would rush to reassure them that my mother being permanently disabled didn't strike me as particularly tragic. Sure, she never worked again, and her life and mine was never the same, but I soldiered through. With my brother's sister and a family friend who was our caretaker, I adapted to the duties of dressing and bathing her, doing the cooking. I tolerated her frustrated outbursts, baffling logic, and memory lapses. Slowly, sadly, I came to understand the shadow of my former mother who could no longer mother me. Yes, it was hard, I would say, but taking care of her taught me responsibility. I grew up quickly, became a better person. I clung to that shiny silver lining, carrying this sunny twist on a dark story through my 20s and 30s. But over those decades, patterns emerged. Romantic relationships, friendships, and family ties drifted away as I hopscotched from place to place. Baton Rouge, Vermont, Paris, Boston. I couldn't seem to make anything last. Eventually, I saw a therapist who suggested that I might have difficulty connecting, trusting, being vulnerable. I remember her saying, "Ethan, that 12-year-old was abandoned. It must have been a devastating trauma." "Oh," I mumbled. "Of course." That truth hit me like a body blow. I soon started telling a different story about myself to myself. Losing my mother on the cusp of adolescence had wrecked me, and ever since I had been withdrawing from others to minimize the risk of abandonment. Recognizing that freed me. When I realized the rosy outlook I thought protected me was in fact hurting me, I finally gave myself permission to grieve what had befallen her, befallen us. As I acknowledged my suffering, I began to repair. I stopped sugarcoating other tough experiences. I no longer turned disastrous breakups into tales of romantic derring-do to amuse my friends. I didn't need to spin being snubbed by a friend, a family member, or an employer as some school of hard knocks lesson whose impact I dodged by moving to another city. Instead, I allowed myself to feel hurt, angry, confused. I came to understand more clearly what was brewing inside me and why. Most important, I began to tell a new version of my tale to other people. I lost my mother at a young age. It was awful. I was traumatized. I'm a survivor. When I said that to my first serious girlfriend since my revelation, she accepted me for who I was. Damaged goods, but on the mend. Eventually, feeling safer and more grown up, I committed to the idea of something lasting. I married her, we bought a home, even acquired a dog, eventually three dogs, all as I entered my 50s. I'm not pretending I'm now a fully evolved humanoid, far from it. I know my emotional black holes and try to avoid their gravitational pull. I still may flinch at being vulnerable, and sometimes I can emotionally shut down, just ask my wife. But when I do, I find compassion for that nerdy 12-year-old inside me whose mother was torn away from him. Today, when this nerdy 55-year-old panics, I don't insist I'll be better off for the suffering. Instead, I tell myself the truth. You're afraid, but you're going to survive. You're going to be okay. Ethan Gilsdorf is a journalist, an essayist, a teacher, and the author of the award-winning memoir, Fantasy Freaks and Gaming Geeks. Our next article by Arena Gonzalez is titled, What is Qi Energy? Everything you need to know about the ancient Chinese term. Have you ever felt off balance but couldn't nail down the exact reason why? Qi may be to blame for your fatigue, brain fog, or irritability. Qi is the energy current that runs through our bodies, providing us with circulation, nutrients, and minerals that we need to be whole, says Taz Bhatia, MD, integrative health expert, founder of CenterSpring MD, and author of Superwoman RX. In traditional Chinese medicine, qi was thought to be the life force and ultimate measure of one's vitality. The ancient art, which has been well vetted and considered safe practice by the National Center for Complementary and Integrative Health, has been used by doctors of integrative medicine and acupuncturists to restore the body to its natural, healthy state and to help people generally achieve a state of zen. Is it qi or qi? Both terms have been used to describe this undercurrent force, and while they are technically interchangeable, they vary slightly based on its cultural origin. It's called qi in Chinese medicine, or prana in Ayurvedic yogic tradition, says Annie McDonald, LAC, of New York's Joy Alchemy Acupuncture. According to the Acupuncture and Massage College in Miami, Florida, it's best to use qi in the context of restoring balance, since that is the physical or nourishing portion that makes up the air, water, and food we take in, whereas qi refers to the vital fluids and the energy itself that flows through our bodies. Regardless, both have to do with working towards feeling a little better day to day. So why exactly is qi critical to health? The answer is simple. It's what courses through the body along meridians, and it also controls the movement of blood, says Jason Wells, ND, LAC, a naturopathic physician and acupuncturist at Reconstructed Wellness in Portland, Oregon. The proper movement of both qi and blood through the body creates health and harmony in the human being, Wells says. The Chinese viewed qi as both an essential energy unit that could be obtained from food, but also a gas or pressure that promotes movement in the body. How do you know when your qi is out of balance? Qi, or once again qi, deficiencies can be caused by a lack of sleep, food, shelter, clean water, fresh air, and other physical elements the human body needs to properly function. An imbalance can also be caused by insufficient mental stimulation, love, and social interaction. According to Reshma Patel, PAC, MMS, founder and CEO of Ananda Integrative Medicine in Los Angeles. She says it's also possible to have excess qi as a result of environmental toxins like polluted air or water, or from too much physical activity, stress, negative emotion, or overeating. What is the right way to balance qi? Luckily, there are ways of getting a little more centered. Patel recommends trying mind-body techniques and practices such as Tai Chi, Qigong, yoga, meditation, Reiki, or a massage. The best thing you can do, Patel says, is to prioritize sleep to avoid getting tired. Wells also suggests taking on acupuncture or hobbies that encourage movement, stretching, and blood flow throughout the body, which can be particularly helpful for injured patients. He also recommends paying closer attention to the causes of your imbalance, not just treating the symptoms. He points out that qi deficiency often results in a lack of nutrients and that it's essential to limit processed foods that can hinder absorption in the gut. Specifically, Wells recommends incorporating stews and broth into your diet. Ultimately, the greatest takeaway is to take it easy a little more often. We balance ki by resting, Taz says, emphasizing the importance of lowering stress by adding exposure to the sun and water. Rest and recovery are essential to restoring the body. Next time someone pokes fun at you for your daily afternoon nap, simply tell them you're doing it for your ki. Our next article is titled, 20 Years After Losing Her Firefighter Husband on 9/11, Marion Fontana Reflects on Raising Their Son. My son Aiden was born a month early. At 25 years old, he is still compulsively on time, probably making up for my notoriously tardy parents who have often left me in lobbies and movie theaters, cursing them. I used to joke that I got married in my parents' backyard so they wouldn't be late for my wedding, but in fact, we got married in my parents' backyard because we couldn't afford other venues. Dave and I were married on September 11, 1993. It was a crystal blue sky day, slightly chilly in the shade, which kept most of the guests on the dance floor two-stepping to the Cajun band. Dave chose the date because he liked telling his firefighter friends that he got married on 911. We met in the arts dorm at college, where he was a sculpture major. Dave became a firefighter so he would have time to sculpt, but his love of firefighting surpassed his love of art, and his love for his new son Aiden eclipsed it all. I had imagined the moment Aiden was born. I had seen it in the movies 100 times, and aside from Rosemary's Baby, there was never a birth scene where I didn't cry. The mother always stared down smiling at her new baby with pure, unfiltered joy. After 16 hours of back labor without an epidural and a final push that broke my tailbone, smiling was the last thing I wanted to do. When Aiden was handed to me, yellow and wrinkled as an overripe mango, the tears of joy came from Dave, who was smitten from the moment he laid eyes on our tiny yellow boy. It turned out Aiden's color was due to jaundice, and he had to stay in the NICU, where they placed his tiny body in a clear box under a heat lamp. He wore a black mask and a diaper the size of a credit card, and Dave joked that he was the world's tiniest sunbather. Every day for a week, we drove back and forth from Brooklyn to Beth Israel Hospital, my breasts bursting with milk I didn't know how to drain. An overworked lactation specialist tried to help, jamming my nipple into Aiden's mouth as if it was the last hot dog in a contest. On an unseasonably warm day in February, we finally took Aiden home, where Dave and I stared at each other, wondering why our baby didn't come with instructions. Dave went back to work, often taking 24-hour shifts. Back at home, Aiden had colic and wailed every hour to eat. It was in those silent moments, feeding Aiden, his tiny hands opening and closing on my finger like a sea creature, that I felt that feeling everyone talked about. It was both primal and pure, the stuff of poetry and Gerber commercials and countless cliches. I was in love. But unlike the Gerber commercials, it was also hard. There were sleepless nights, postpartum depression, and fights with Dave over who was more tired. We were broke, exhausted, overwhelmed, but we always landed on the soft cushion of our new family. We created rituals with Aiden. We gave him a bath, read him a book, sang hushabye from our music together class. Finally, we kissed his warm head and said, "We love you more than the stars," slowly closing the door behind us. Then everything changed. On September 11, 2001, our 8th wedding anniversary, Dave was getting off a 24-hour shift. Aiden was 5. It was his second day of kindergarten, and the sky was the same color as our wedding day. Everyone knows the story, how the world changed. Our tiny family shattered like glass. Dave was gone. Neighbors and family poured in and out like grieving ants. The postman delivered packages from around the world filled with homemade quilts, letters, flags, and Build-A-Bears singing God Bless America. I wanted to cover 5-year-old Aiden in bubble wrap in order to protect him, not only from the world's grief, but from my own. I kept our rituals in place. I gave him a bath, I read him a book, I sang hushabye, my voice cracked with tears. "I love you more than the stars," I said quickly, shutting the door so he wouldn't see my sorrow. I formed my own nighttime rituals. I drank wine, I smoked cigarettes, I listened to Joni Mitchell. I wish I had a river I could skate away on. I attended endless funerals, memorials, and events, always rushing home for my son's bedtime, but I often missed it. He began waking up at night again, crying from a bad dream he couldn't remember. I let him climb into my bed then and kissed his wet face, saying, "I love you more than the stars," until one night he said, "Do you love me more than Daddy?" "No, I love you differently." "Because he's not here?" "Because he's your daddy and you're my boy," I said. When he seemed satisfied, I rolled onto my side so he couldn't see me cry and drifted off into the dreamless, restless sleep I had then. After a year, I reluctantly left Brooklyn for Staten Island to be closer to my parents and make a fresh start. Aiden seemed happy to have a yard to play in and attended a school where no one knew who he was. I bathed him in our new tub and read him a story in a bigger bed. I sang Hashabai and whispered, "I love you more than the stars," from the doorway of his room. I sat on my porch, the crickets replacing the traffic. I drank wine and smoked cigarettes and listened to Joni Mitchell. "I am on a lonely road and I am traveling, traveling, traveling." Years passed as fast as breaths. I made new friends. I traveled. I wrote a book. I dated a lot. I went to trauma therapy. I composed lists. My world still spun fast, but I kept the bedtime ritual Dave and I had started. Aiden bathed on his own now, though. He lined up his plastic army men on the edge of the tub where he held epic bloody battle scenes. Since his books no longer had pictures, I sat in a chair next to his bed reading the Narnia Chronicles, Wind in the Willows, and Harry Potter. We sang the Beatles together or the theme songs to cartoons he watched, but "I Love You More Than the Stars" always stayed the same. Even when I quit smoking, my buried sorrow remained, a cold lump in the back of my throat that I tried to breathe away in yoga, meditation, and in relationships with men. Aiden struggled too. I spoke to teachers in letters, ADHD, PTSD, IEPs, but every night we kept our sacred routine, two survivors alone on a raft of grief that only we understood. When Aiden was 14, I was diagnosed with breast cancer, and my therapist predicted a wild rebellion would ensue. His acting out began small at first, wet towels on the floor and a trail of socks like Hansel and Gretel breadcrumbs. More often than not, the socks turned out to be mine, stretched and useless from the occupation of Aiden's now size 15 feet. Lights were left on in every room, empty cartons of orange juice were put back in the refrigerator, and I had to hide my headphones so he wouldn't steal them. He took long hot showers instead of baths and didn't need me to read or sing. "I love you more than the stars," I called from downstairs. "You too," he mumbled back. Aiden started staying up late listening to music, his walls now covered in Nirvana and Jimi Hendrix posters. His hair began to curl and a slight mustache lined his upper lip. After radiation treatments, I dragged him to auditions for LaGuardia and Talent Unlimited, where he played Nirvana's heart-shaped box on my old Martin guitar. "I wish I could eat your cancer when you turn black." Halfway through his freshman year of high school, Aiden cut his hair, took down his posters, and started listening to rap. An unfamiliar tension lodged itself between us. He wore headphones in the car and spent hours making beats and murdering people in video games. By sophomore year, Aiden was listening to what he called underground hip-hop. He greeted me with a "what up," his pants slung so low he walked the way he did as a toddler with a full diaper. He reeked of pot, his giant eyes now permanently set to half-mast. The lump in my throat became worry that never left, worry that kept me up at night. When I dreamt, I was the only one left, sad and alone. I sent Aiden to therapists, tutors, and yoga classes, but he was a stormy sea, his moods as mutable as the weather. We fought often, his door slamming behind him after he stomped up the stairs. He ran away to friends' houses and continued to flounder in school. At the therapist's suggestion, I started each sentence with, "I love you, but..." Aiden's struggles became my secret sorrow as my friends talked about college tours and acceptance letters while Aiden wanted a gap year. I offered up possible adventures from living with pandas in China to working on an elephant farm in Thailand, but he preferred to be a busboy at a coffee shop in Union Square. Aiden came home long after I was asleep. His room always reeked of weed and sweat. I tried saying, "I love you, but," which launched what I called Aiden's marijuana logs, citing articles about the myriad benefits of cannabis. I felt like I was living with a half lawyer, half auctioneer, my son always bargaining and pontificating. I became too tired to fight. I was busy driving my sister to NYU's cancer center. She had recently been diagnosed with breast cancer, worse than mine. On other nights, I simply fell into bed and never slept, making a mental gratitude list for the things that I appreciated. A is for Aiden, B is for beauty, C is for creativity. When Aiden finally went off to college, I was relieved. After 15 years of single parenting, I could finally attend to my to-do list, one that was much longer than the novel I was writing. Aiden seemed happy at school, texting me, "I love you," with heart emojis. The days drifted like leaves on a lake, and in less than 3 months, he was home, moved back for good. I found out later that he had fallen down a flight of stairs and had a traumatic brain injury, though he'd never told me. Aiden mostly sat in his room with no lights on, his head throbbing, averting the light like a mole. He usually slept until late afternoon, his eyes red and swollen. There were no more emojis, and he'd grown quiet. He'd never been quiet. He ignored my texts and didn't respond when I whispered "I love you" into the seam of his closed door. My sister's cancer worsened, determined to find other places to go. Her bones, her liver, her lungs. Sometimes I wondered if I had been Hitler in a past life. Aiden acted out as I took him to concussion experts. Thankfully, finally, he zeroed in on audio engineering school, waking each morning without complaint and always arriving on time. At his graduation, a man in his early 60s with a wide, toothy smile recounted how Aiden had stayed late, teaching him a music program he was struggling to understand. "You raised a beautiful human being," he said, smiling in a way that immediately made me cry. That winter, as Aiden turned 22, my sister was dying. I was sure life had finally permanently knocked me down. My therapist suggested radical self-care and a timeline for Aiden to move out. He and I agreed to less than 3 months, and in two, he'd packed his things and moved in with my parents. While I had mixed feelings about his decision, it would turn out to be kismet in the months ahead. He texted and called often just to say hi, regaling me with funny anecdotes about his new housemates. The heart emojis returned. A few months later, I arrived at my sister's house on what would be her last night. She was weak and reminded me of a baby bird. She was trying to sit up, crying into what was left of her hair. I told her I loved her. Aiden came over, and when she vomited a bucket full of blood, he quietly cleaned it up, telling her he loved her too and that it was okay to go. He had read the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and at 24 was now philosophical about death. My sister died the following morning on December 14, 2019, my father's 83rd birthday. Her husband was cradling her head, and her youngest daughter was stretched out next to her. I was holding her hand, watching her labored breathing, until I felt the pulse in her hand suddenly stop. When I texted Aiden that she was gone, he sent 8 heart emojis. Half of them were broken. It seemed almost fitting that the pandemic began sending everyone into their apartments and homes. Watching the news and the impossibly high numbers of sick and dying felt eerily familiar. I was now grateful Aiden was living with my parents. He made sure they wore masks and kept them safe. I moved upstate, receding into the mountains where the days and nights were sewn together in a surreal quilt of fear and quiet. Aiden called often, regaling me with more stories about my parents. He made me laugh when I didn't feel like it. When my son turned 25, I helped him move out of my parents' house and into an apartment. He had survived COVID, isolating in what used to be the maid's quarters in the back of his grandparents' Queen Anne. I found him a place on the top floor of a friend's old Victorian near the Staten Island Ferry. It had 3 cozy rooms painted in bright colors with peaked roofs and closets that reminded me of the Harry Potter books we'd read together years ago. He decorated bookshelves with shrines to Dave, my sister, and his close friend Jimmy, who had also died of cancer. We hiked when he visited upstate, and I began to sleep over at his place when I came down to the city. He made me cappuccinos, showed me the African movie posters he'd framed, and played me the most recent beats he'd put together. He was funny, smart, and taller than Dave, 6'3", with stooped shoulders from carrying heavy backpacks to high school. He was strikingly handsome with his father's straight nose and square chin. His thick eyebrows were like mine. "What do you want to do for the 20th anniversary?" I asked him on a recent visit. It was hard to believe it had been 20 years. It felt both like another lifetime and as though it had just happened. I still thought about Dave every day. "I just want to be alone with you at a beach," Aiden answered. We talked about Dave and his years as a lifeguard at Jones Beach, how Aiden had inherited his dad's love of the sand, ocean, and nature. "He'd be proud of you," I told Aiden, the familiar lump in my throat returning. "I sort of remember you guys tucking me in," Aiden recalled. His memories had begun to fade, like photographs kept in boxes too long. "Yep," I said, smiling and remembering. "That's when he told you he loved you more than the stars." Our next article, as told to Ashley Halpern, is titled Adventures and Empowerment. In a male-dominated field, these two women, both working for NASA, have found ways to help each other soar. For Susan Martinez, 24, it wasn't enough to merely work as an operations control engineer for the International Space Station, supporting the astronauts from the Payload Operations and Integration Center at NASA Marshall Space Flight Center. She wanted to also encourage other women to get into STEM, so she started an Instagram account, @Adastrasu, to engage with followers about her career. That's when she came across @YourFemaleEngineer, an already popular account with the same goal run by Joan Melendez Misner, 30, a NASA engineer and part-time science communicator. She sent a direct message, and Melendez Misner was quick to virtually show her the ropes. They began texting and calling each other, and their initially surface-level connection grew into the juggernaut of support that it is today. "That is the beauty of social media," says Martinez. "You can change someone's life without having met them in person. Here's how it all unfolded, with lessons we can learn from their mentorship, too." Susan says, "When I first started my account, I knew I wanted it to be STEM-focused, but I didn't want to pigeonhole myself. I talked extensively with Joan about ways I can incorporate nail art, fashion, makeup, and other things that interest me. She helped me with my self-confidence and made sure I knew it was okay to be myself, especially at work." Joan says, "As someone who has been in the industry for almost 10 years, it is easy to lose yourself trying to fit in. When I first started, I would wear polo shirts like my male colleagues. I would not express my thoughts in meetings. Now I am a lead engineer and have found my confidence, both professionally and personally. I share a lot of my struggles and success on social media because I want other people to relate to it." Susie is more than an engineer. She loves fashion. I told her to embrace this. "We are all unique in STEM, and that makes you stand out in the crowd. I focus on STEM, space, and motivation for STEM careers. Susie could easily focus on STEM and fashion and run with it because not many people have that niche. She is more than just a woman in STEM, and that's ultimately what we want to showcase. She is changing the way engineers are portrayed." Susan says, "Joan helped me understand that not every post is going to be a success, not every company will want to work with you, and not every opportunity is worth the stress. She has steered me away from many a fishy deal. I appreciate her taking the time to make sure all the people we work with are legit. I also get frustrated where post-success is concerned. A lot of social media posts I think will perform well just don't. Other times you spend 30 seconds on something and it goes viral. That's the nature of the game, but Joan is always the first person to say, 'Hey, I know this didn't go how you expected it to, but I liked it and I'm here to support you.' Being a woman empowering other women in a public space, it's risky business. I have friends who get bombarded with hate comments for their women in STEM content. It has been so nice to have Joan to cry and complain to when those things happen. She's a safe space in a judgmental place." Joan says, "I have also come across microaggressions. In a predominantly male-dominated industry, you will sometimes hear, 'You're too pretty to be an engineer,' or 'You'll get the job, the interviewer likes you.' It is very discouraging when your intelligence is secondary to your looks, which is why it's important to showcase what we go through in order to change the environment. I fundamentally believe failure is not the opposite of success. It is part of every success story. With social media, it's hard to not play the comparison game. I reminded Susie the algorithm is unpredictable. One day I have a lot of views on a reel or video, and the other, it flops. I told her to have fun with it. We are changing lives, and that should be the overall goal. Even if we reach one little girl who now wants to pursue STEM because she watches our videos, then you have done more than any view count can offer. Our next article is told to Ashley Halpern, is titled The Making of a Nurtureship. They met when one of them wanted lessons in how to lead. Now they're building a business together and leaning on each other to create the lives they want. Long before Jenny Hicks, 39, and Vanessa Hernandez, 38, co-created their consulting firm, JVH Empower, to bring heart-centered solutions to ending racism and hate in all its forms, the two crossed paths in their social activism work. At first, Hernandez viewed Hicks, who was more established in the field, as a mentor of sorts. It wasn't until a conversation turned personal that both realized the mutual takeaways of their deepening connection. The story of what they call their nurtureship reveals the multifaceted benefits of mentoring and the growth that can happen when we dare ourselves to be vulnerable. Jenny says, Vanessa and I met a little over 10 years ago when I led a social activist initiative called House ED. We noticed a growing trend that children living in public and affordable housing were experiencing inequitable access to out-of-school time resources like after-school and summer services. House ED united housing agencies from all over the U.S. and supported them in offering youth services as a fundamental step toward creating equitable educational outcomes. Vanessa was a resident services coordinator at one of the largest Bay Area housing agencies. Over time, I became her mentor, and she expanded her housing organization's youth service offerings from 3 after-school programs to 36. Vanessa says, Jenny was recommended to me as someone who was leading initiatives for high-quality youth programs and housing. I was really vibing with that. She invited me to an event, and that's where I first saw this woman of color commanding a space in a very loving and gentle way. It aligned with how I like to show up in the world, my philosophy and pedagogy around leadership. Everything she was saying was music to my ears. I joined her cohort, and she gave me individual coaching. I saw how much conscious intention she put into everything, from the way she structured the agenda, to the ambiance of the room, to the word she chooses. Says Jenny, I was at the peak of my career running a national initiative that thousands of people were implementing when I just broke down. All of a sudden, I was in a dark place and couldn't understand where this deep emptiness was coming from. I remember being in the hospital and just feeling like, how did I end up here? Eventually, I got out of the hospital and back to traveling. I was at a conference in Philly when someone tapped my back. It was Vanessa. I was so exhausted. I must have aged 8 to 10 years since the last time I had seen her. She told me to just relax, breathe. Over dinner, I told her how I'd been feeling. That's when she told me about the trauma she had experienced as a child. We had very similar stories. What shifted was her seeing me in pain because I was someone she had looked up to. That's when my mentee became my mentor. Says Vanessa, Jenny taught me what it was like to show up authentically and to lead lovingly and gently. Accountability to self is where I have a lot of experience. I understood that inward journey so I could show her how to awaken that power and activate her inner healer. Says Jenny, with Vanessa's expertise in trauma healing, mental health and wellness, and mine in community development, brokering partnerships and resources, we left our respective agencies and started a business. At JVH Empower, we co-create empowered communities where all are seen and heard and belong, particularly those in the BIPOC community. We hold space for these leaders and help them shed their pain. Says Vanessa, Jenny is a Black woman. I'm a Mexican woman. If you look at our historical and intergenerational trauma, we've evolved that into a partnership of exploring what inner healing work really needs to look like so we can embody that sisterhood. I want to be here to reflect her healing back to her, to cheer her on and hold her accountable. We call it a nurtureship. Says Jenny, being a leader can feel very lonely, like you need to know all the answers and be everything to everyone else. What I've learned is that it's okay to humbly ask for help, to admit when I'm feeling hurt or lost, and to let others support me. You know the saying about putting on your own oxygen mask before helping others. People who do service work adapt this self-sacrificing mindset, like, I'm going to run around the plane and see how many people I can put a mask on before I pass out. Together, we learned that if we are going to be role models to others, we have to take care of ourselves first. Our next article by Karen Duffy is titled, The Stoic's Guide to Navigating the World in Uncertain Times. I'm a social butterfly who likes to flit from lunch to a dinner party to early breakfast with friends at the Bonbonniere, the best greasy spoon in New York City. I find my life is better with my good friends. The Stoic philosopher Epictetus said, the key is to keep company only with people who uplift you, whose presence calls forth your best. When I am with my friends, I am borne aloft. The lockdown clipped my wings and turned me into a housefly. I've got ants in my pants to stretch my wings again. Caterpillars undergo a nearly complete transformation in the course of their lives. This is called holometabolism. When a furry caterpillar reaches maturity, it creates a hard shell around its body called a chrysalis. Inside the chrysalis, the caterpillar begins to decompose into a broth of the lyrically named imaginal cells. These cells carry the blueprint of the future. In the chrysalis, the cells begin to reassemble and recompose into a new form. When the new body is complete and ready, the miraculous insect cracks open the chrysalis with its legs. This is called eclosion. What emerges is a butterfly. We have spent the pandemic in our own protective shells, and we are also beginning to emerge. This past year and a half of quarantine and isolation has been our time in the chrysalis, keeping ourselves safe inside. We went from social butterflies to antisocial butterflies. We hope soon it will be time to recompose ourselves and eclose, and that may turn out to be scary. We are separate but united in apprehension about breaking out of the chrysalis. Yet, as Marcus Aurelius, the Roman emperor and Stoic philosopher, wrote, frightened of change? But what can exist without it? What's closer to nature's heart? At the beginning of the lockdown, four of my closest friends and I started a tradition of regular Zoom calls. Since then, I have spent every Thursday evening with my pandemic coterie. We call these virtual get-togethers the Thursday Night Save My Life Club, and we have had theme nights like Grey Gardens and Cantina with cocktails to match. We've been alone together. Booze and jokes and camaraderie were the imaginal cells of our long isolation. Now we long for the chance to leave our chrysalises and to spread our wings. The French word retrouval describes the joy of reuniting with loved ones. We are all double vaccinated, and I am ready to celebrate this joy, but our first meeting will be in the garden. One friend still has butterflies in her stomach and does not want to meet indoors, especially now with the variants hovering. She is still inside her chrysalis, recomposing, and is not yet ready for a gathering of her own species. Like different types of caterpillars, our metabolisms run at different rates. If you jimmied open a chrysalis, which you shouldn't do, you would see a few tiny structures remaining from the creature's life as a caterpillar, such as the feet. It is a complex and major transformation, but not a total one. There is even evidence that butterflies can retain the caterpillar's memories. As we emerge from our chrysalises, what will we retain? We must ask ourselves, who are we now? What will we leave behind, and what will we bring with us? When faced with such big questions and uncertain times, I look for guidance in my philosophical practice. A life philosophy is an attitude. It is your vision for your life. It's your purpose. It holds me together in troubling times. For the past 2 decades, I have found strength and solace in my daily habit of reading the Stoics. Not to be confused with small s Stoicism, which means keeping a stiff upper lip. Uppercase Stoicism is a vibrant, practical philosophy that offers a roadmap to living a virtuous and vigorous life. A principal Stoic tenet is that we can't control what happens, we can only control how we respond. Epictetus, one of the wisest and wittiest Stoics who has ever drawn a breath, said that if your choices are beautiful, so too will you be. This lit me up like a jar full of fireflies. If I were the type of person who used needles and ink to permanently apply words and symbols on my body, this quote would be my tramp stamp, right above the always popular butterfly tattoo. The Stoic philosophers believe that life is not against us, but for us. The obstacles we face are infused with opportunities. Epictetus reminds us that the trials you will encounter will introduce you to your strength. When the world slowed down, it gave me the chance to examine my life more closely. The first microscopes were called fly glasses because they were used to study small insects. In the words of early microscope builder Peter Burrell, a flea is enlarged to the size of a camel and a fly to the size of an elephant. Stoicism became my butterfly glass as I took close inventory of my life and magnified myself to the size of a whale. Not all parts of me were flattered by this treatment. If you look at a caterpillar under a microscope, you'd see that they don't have a backbone. They are invertebrates. During their transformation in the chrysalis, butterflies grow a sturdy exoskeleton to support themselves. Stoicism is my exoskeleton and gives me resilience in the face of events beyond my control. The metamorphosis of caterpillars into butterflies inspires me to reflect on the fact that we will all go through times of darkness and we can emerge as something beautiful. I won't miss lockdown, but I've gained a deeper appreciation of the cycle of nature, watching the flora and fauna of the living world transform outside my window. The butterfly effect is a poetic expression of chaos theory, the concept that infinitesimally small actions can cause world-changing events. MIT professor Edward Lorenz gave rise to the name when he posed the question, "Can a butterfly flapping its wings in Brazil cause a tornado in Texas?" For Lorenz, chaos theory is written on the wings of fluttering insects. A titanic occurrence is birthed in a microscopic action. From one tiny movement, an immense result can occur. Our whole world has been upended by a microscopic thing, a virus, a bug. The pandemic has been heartbreaking. But in this heartbreak is an opportunity to make changes in ourselves, to revise and do better. We have the possibility to improve, reinforce values we want to keep, leave behind what is unnecessary, and find opportunities in new beginnings. Seneca, the Roman Stoic philosopher and politician, wrote that every new beginning comes from some other's beginning's end. When the pandemic comes to an end, it will be time for us to make a new beginning. The butterfly is a symbol of rebirth that reminds us that we're now ready to reanimate our lives. As the great Taoist philosopher Chuang Tzu remarked, just when the caterpillar thought the world was over, it became a butterfly. The lockdown has been our chrysalis, our transformation, our time of metamorphosis. It is in the season of the chrysalis that the caterpillar grows its wings. We are survivors. Let's embrace it. Marcus Aurelius led the Roman Empire through perpetual war and years of plague. He kept a journal of his thoughts, which are preserved in a book we call Meditations. He was a man with the weight of the world on him, yet he wrote, "When you arise in the morning, think of what a precious privilege it is to be alive. To breathe, to think, to enjoy, to love. We have all of these things before us. Caterpillars eat leaves, which is fine if you're in the mood for a salad, but butterflies drink the sweet nectar of flowers. Let's take off and find the sweetness in life. We have been through a lot and have had to make a lot of changes. It can seem daunting to have to remake ourselves again, but it is necessary. Maya Angelou said that we delight in the beauty of the butterfly, but rarely admit the change it has gone through to achieve that beauty. Change doesn't happen when everything is going fine. Things change because they have to change because they aren't working. When the pandemic passes, the strong measures we took to keep safe must change. The butterfly effect shows us that great changes can come from small actions. Martin Luther King Jr. said, "Take the first step in faith. You don't have to see the whole staircase, just take the first step." We can begin now. It's time to fly. We've earned our wings. Karen Duffy is a New York Times best-selling author and a member of Modern Stoics. Her new book on Stoic philosophy, Wise Up, will be published in April 2022. Our next article by Elena Nicolou is titled, "Oprah Invests in Spanx 21 Years After Naming It One of Her Favorite Things." Followers of Oprah's Favorite Things know that Oprah is a big fan of Spanx. Back in 2000, Oprah added the company's flattering pantyhose to her annual product roundup. 20 years later, she chose Spanx Perfect Black Pant for her yearly holiday gift list. In fact, Oprah loved the high-rise pants so much, she called Spanx CEO Sarah Blakely to applaud her after trying them on. Now Oprah is taking an active role in the next stage of the company's evolution by joining forces with Reese Witherspoon and Bumble founder Whitney Wolf Heard as investors in the women's shapewear brand, which is valued at $1.2 billion, the New York Times reported. Blackstone, a private equity group, bought a majority stake in the company in October 2021. Spanx really changed the way I wore clothes, Oprah said of the pantyhose, which are designed to smooth the appearance of the body under clothing, on The Oprah Show in 2006. When Sarah first came on The Oprah Show to tell us about her idea for Spanx, I knew it was brilliant. We'd all been cutting off our pantyhose for years, so from the moment I wore my first pair, they became a staple in my wardrobe. It's remarkable the business that Sarah and her team have created with the comfort and support of all women at the heart of their creations, and I'm happy to be a part of the evolution, Oprah said in an official statement. Now an investor in the company, Oprah is also part of Spanx's founding mythology. When Spanx founder Blakely was 27, she was working as a door-to-door fax machine salesperson in Florida. As an experiment, Blakely cut the feet off control-top pantyhose she was wearing with a new pair of white pants. She was shocked by the effect the simple change had on her clothing. They made me look a size smaller, smoothed everything out, and got rid of the panty line. I thought, this should exist for women, she told Oprah in 2006. Not everyone was sold on Blakely's vision. As she told Oprah, she had called hosiery mills and pitched various men on her idea for a shorter, slimming pantyhose. Nobody thought it was a good idea, she said. Before abandoning her idea entirely, Blakely asked for a sign. Then she flipped on the TV and saw Oprah talking about how she, too, cuts the feet off her pantyhose. You're my sign, which means I'm going for it, Blakely said. From there, Blakely created a patent and started the company out of her apartment using the $5,000 in her savings account. The journey has been amazing. I feel like you've been present the whole journey, Blakely said the first time she met Oprah in 2006. The journey continued earlier this year when Blakely sold a majority stake of Spanx to the global investment firm Blackstone. Blakely celebrated the sale by giving each of her employees 2 first-class Delta tickets to anywhere in the world, as well as a $10,000 bonus. Witherspoon applauded Blakely's role as a leader in an official statement. In addition to developing a remarkable product and business that literally supports women every day, Sarah has become a role model for leveraging your success to elevate other women. To have the support of these smart, thoughtful, world-class female founders who have also disrupted their industries to elevate and support women means everything, Spanx founder Sarah Blakely said in an official statement. Our next article by Samantha Vincenti and Mackenzie Jean Philippe is titled Happiness Quotes from Inspiring Women That'll Instantly Make Your Day. Oprah. Know what sparks the light in you so that you, in your own way, can illuminate the world. Meghan Markle. We just need to be kinder to ourselves. If we treated ourselves the way we treated our best friend, can you imagine how much better off we would be? Gabrielle Union. Number 4, Ellen DeGeneres. Anger and aggression weaken you because they take so much energy to hold in place. But kindness is a strength that makes you more serene. Julia Roberts. One of the first steps to happiness is deciding that you want to be happy and knowing what that means. I have had many full-on conversations about what that looks like to me. To be happy is a choice you make every day, every hour, and refining and renewing that state is a constant pursuit. Betty White. Accentuate the positive, not the negative. It sounds so trite, but a lot of people will pick out something to complain about rather than say, hey, that was great. It's not hard to find great stuff if you look. Beyonce. There are many shades on every journey. Nothing is black or white. I've been through hell and back, and I'm grateful for every scar. Michelle Obama. I know that all I can do is be the best me that I can and live life with some gusto. Maya Angelou. You may not control all the events that happen to you, but you can decide not to be reduced by them. Minda Kaling. If you got it, flaunt it. If you don't got it, flaunt it. Reese Witherspoon. All those things that you're worried about are not important. You're going to be okay. Better than okay. You're going to be great. Spend less time tearing yourself apart, worrying if you're good enough. You are good enough, and you're going to meet amazing people in your life who will help you and love you. Drew Barrymore. I think happiness is what makes you pretty, period. Happy people are beautiful. They become like a mirror and they reflect that happiness. Anais Nin. I don't really want to become normal, average, standard. I want merely to gain in strength and the courage to live out my life more fully, enjoy more, experience more. Diane Nadd. You're never too old to chase your dreams. Cleo Wade. Gratitude is a celebration we are all invited to. Audre Lorde. If I didn't define myself for myself, I would be crunched into other people's fantasies for me and eaten alive. Goldie Hawn. I've come to believe that seeking happiness is not a frivolous pursuit. It's honorable and necessary, and most people forget even to think about it. Lamotte. To love yourself as you are is a miracle, and to seek yourself is to have found yourself for now. And now is all we have, and love is who we are. Agatha Christie. Just to be alive is a grand thing. Dolly Parton. If you're comfortable with yourself and know yourself, you're going to shine and radiate, and other people are going to be drawn to you. Iris Murdoch. One of the secrets of a happy life is continuous small treats, and if some of these can be inexpensive and quickly procured, so much the better. Priyanka Chopra. The joy of creating is the truest joy. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.